This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 41, and I have the pleasure to be joined once again by Rupert Taylor, CEO of AltFi Data, who first appeared on the show a year ago, giving an overview of the whole alternative finance scene. It would be odd that he's on the show again, as he hasn't bribed me. However, he and the AltFi Data team did recently put a lot of effort into a report which they released in conjunction with City Lawyers Nabarro, entitled, Where Are They Now? A Report into the Status of Companies That Have Raised Finance Using Equity Crowdfunding in the UK. Not just that, but at the report's production there were some rather nice Danish pastries. Who said I'm expensive to buy? The response of the media, old and new to this, was an interesting phenomenon in itself, and one that shows that no matter how much care one takes, folks will always spin your report through their own lens. We'll get onto that later in the show. But first, for those of you who aren't aware of the depths of the challenge in this area, the acting head of the FCA and the chairman of the FCA were grilled recently by the UK government's Treasury Select Committee. Perhaps the most shocking aspect of this was the lack of grip the FCA appeared to have on the data on alternative finance, venturing that P2P losses were, quotes, around 1%, which is rather vague and a little oversimplistic given the huge difference between the provision-based P2P model and the marketplace P2P model. Furthermore, they mentioned that the FCA insists that equity crowdfunding platforms make it clear the majority of startups fail. This is perhaps based on the oft-quoted figure that 9 in 10 startups fail, which we'll come on to later, especially as this appears to be a myth. What a tangle, how ungrounded in actual data this all was. Why they don't just insist upon the platforms reporting actual data to them rather than speculating, or frankly just reading the AltFi Data website, which has regularly updated stats on the P2P market, is beyond me. Anyway, it's good to see the private sector step into all of this. As we will go on to see, even to answer the question, how many companies that raised equity crowd funds in the UK are still going, is a lot of work. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Rupert. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Good to see you again, Mike.
I was stalking you on LinkedIn recently. Well, actually, I wasn't stalking you on LinkedIn recently. I must have been very bored to be looking at your profile. And there was something about momentum on it, which I didn't quite understand, as clearly you have a lot of momentum yourself. But what was that about?
That's very good of you to say, albeit, well, I certainly hope accurate. So yeah, momentum is unrelated.
Excellent. That's what we like to start with. Something's completely irrelevant. Far more interesting, isn't it?
It's nothing to do with crowdfunding, that's for sure. So Momentum is a charity that I founded with a really old school friend of mine, probably 5 years ago now. And the story essentially is that we were lucky enough to go to Wellington College. And Wellington College had recently helped fund an academy under the original academy system. So under the original academy system, a school had to prove that it was failing, and it could then free itself from local education authority control, which is actually, to my mind, the critical part of the academy program. But under the Blair government, the school would also get a very large check to help it reinvent itself. And Wellington Academy is...
And just pressing pause for the 50% of listeners who aren't in the UK, Wellington is what in the UK we call a public school, which actually, in the crazy English fashion, really to everybody else means a private school.
Correct.
And so this is a private school helping the what is really a public school.
Exactly. So Wellington College, my school, is a private school, which is helping a state academy. So yeah, a state school or public school.
English is appalling on this one. Well, of course, public schools were called public schools in the first place because the public, either the wealthier members, could go to them when there wasn't a state education. But anyway, English is such an awful language. We'll carry on using it.
Right? Exactly. Yeah, we're all confused now. Nonetheless, Wellington Academy is a wonderful school, which very quickly went from the bottom of all the league tables to the top of all the league tables. And we figured that there was an opportunity to help the students who are now getting some decent grades, beginning to go to university for the first time in the school's history, but were still lacking the sort of opportunities that had been available to myself and my co-founder. So not particularly good guidance, minimal job opportunities in the local area. And really what we're doing is all about what I see as the tyranny of work experience. So number one, unless you're well connected, it can be hard to find the work experience opportunities. But number two, work experience notoriously is unpaid. And even if it is paid, to do work experience in London, if you don't live in London, you need to get yourself to London, you need to find accommodation.
So it's a barrier to entry because you need money in the first place. And if mum and dad ain't got none.
There is a horrendous barrier to entry that doesn't even allow many students to get the opportunity to do work experience, to get the opportunity to see what's out there and see what else they could do, rather than just what's in the confines of their local area. So effectively, we run a work experience program for 2 weeks every summer. We had more than 20 students on the program this summer. We've expanded it to another academy in the local area. And we try and identify students who we think will make the most of the opportunity and that we can help. And we bring them up to London, put them in a range of work experience roles. And we hugely benefit ourselves from watching them thrive and feeling good about trying to pass on some of our limited wisdom. It's really fun. It's really fun. And it, you know, it's really feels like it's beginning to bear fruit in terms of the charity itself.
Maybe this squares a circle, because when you were giving the report, which we'll come on to in a minute, a week ago, there seemed to be a lot of manual labour that went into it. So maybe you've got sort of 20 City Academy people there following all these companies on Twitter trying to find out what's going.
I will admit to using an intern to do a certain amount of the data mining. He was excellent, very imaginative and creative in terms of figuring out the answer to where these companies are. And I must add, he was also well paid.
Yes, that's very good. It really distresses me to see interns of any background, frankly, being ripped off and treated like slave labour. And it's not politically correct to say, but it, nevertheless, it remains the truth that in the UK, if you have money and are prepared to spend it, you can get an excellent education for your children, just as you can get excellent healthcare. But if unfortunately you're born to parents that don't have enough money, it's much harder, depending on where you live, to get good healthcare and good education, and these are the basics. So it's really useful. And the other thing that struck me in terms of my indirect experience by my elder daughter is that it's not just a question of money, actually. It's a question of conditioning and expectations. So my elder daughter, who, let's try and find more international language, who goes to a private school, was helping teach maths at a state school as part of the sort of whole try and helping the community thing. And occasionally she would come across children who were naturally gifted at maths and really very able. And it wasn't the difficulty of teaching them maths or passing on some of her stuff, both of which was fairly easy. The real difficulty was that they didn't believe they could actually get anywhere. They put a ceiling on them. Well, actually, they hadn't put a ceiling on them, but society, the parents, the culture, the school, you know. So, you know, the thing that sort of broke her heart most was just trying to encourage kids, look, actually, you're really good at maths. And it was very hard to get them to change their belief system. There's a sort of cultural thing as well as a financial aspect here.
Yeah, a huge part of it is just showing students what's out there, what they could do, and that this is available to them.
Yeah. Did the Duke of Wellington go to Wellington College? I've completely forgotten. Or did he found
it? No, he founded it.
He founded it. Yeah. Okay. Well, he did quite well, didn't he?
He did extremely well. The knowledge of that history was drummed into me in my first couple of weeks at Wellington.
An ad nauseam.
Yeah, exactly. And then most of it feels like it's dropped out now.
Excellent. So a year ago you were here, and in fact we were here in this very same room, in fact, talking about alternative finance, and you must have read a very good Chinese fortune cookie that morning, because something you said actually stuck in my mind, Rupert, which is fairly amazing, which was that alternative finance is just a new way of funneling excess liquidity to places where there's a deficit. And at the time, you were just getting going on the AltFi data indices in the P2P sector and all that kind of stuff. And my observation from sort of going to odd conference and that is that it's gone incredibly well since then, because you've got a hell of a lot on perhaps the only hardcore data in terms of what's going on in the UK market. So you seem to have done very well, haven't you?
Yeah, we're really excited. I mean, we certainly see ourselves as the only independent data analytics company out there. And we strongly believe that asset classes only emerge and evolve if they can demonstrate what returns are available. And the only way to demonstrate what returns are available is based off pricing history. And, you know, we're working very hard to get our arms around as much of that data as possible to enable us to provide the most complete picture of what returns have been and what's actually going on in this space. And I have to say, we've been hugely assisted by the transparency of the platforms. So the peer-to-peer platforms recognize that their skin in the game, if you like, is their transparency. One of the criticisms of P2P has been these platforms might be pricing credit risk more intelligently, they might be removing a huge amount of cost, but where's their skin in the game? They're not taking any risk. Well, we feel it's already being very clearly demonstrated that their skin in the game is their reputation and their track record. And the platforms recognize this, and so they have been admirably transparent about their track record. They are very prepared to show everybody what loans they've made and how those loans have played out.
Yes, and so the context that I think is that you've got at least five, by now the leading five, P2P players in the UK who, off the top of my head, when I looked at it last, in the last 3 months, have done 85% of all P2P volumes in the UK, which is an incredible amount. They've got all of their portfolios, every deal they've ever done, is available for download on your site.
Yeah, so we've actually got four out of five. So we've got an agreement with all five. Four out of five, the data is available at the moment.
Just pressing pause on that, I mean, that really is kind of remarkable. So you can go to your site, and okay, when you've got the fifth one done, you can go to your site and see basically 85%, for the sake of argument, of all deals ever done. I know the arithmetic doesn't work out, but you know, it's that kind of thing. And you just couldn't imagine being able to do that for the banking sector. You know, you put your money into a bank, you've got no idea where it goes.
No, and equally, you know, turning back the clock a year ago, it was impossible to define what returns were actually being achieved. And actually, if it's not shameless flag waving at this point, I'd love to...
Shamelessly wave a flag. Yes.
Shamelessly wave a flag. And just a note that, you know, we're now doing the same in the US. So the US marketplace is very different. And the big two platforms represent over 60% of the US market and happily are prepared to adhere to similar levels of transparency. So we have now trailed a prototype of what will become our US returns series.
Okay, well, let's come on to that at the end when we come to the Alt5 data. So having shamelessly waved flags where no one has shamelessly waved flags before about what a brilliant job you guys have been doing in P2P, leaping forward on the media response to your excellent report on the hard work, there was a whole range of responses, but one of which is, this is rubbish, from some of the usual suspects in that context. But I think that point omits entirely how much hard work you had to do to get some basic stuff, like how many people have raised it in the first place and how many of them are going. So let's take us on to the equity thing where it's much less defined. You've got nowhere near like every deal ever done and everything ever happened to every deal ever done from the platforms, which we'll come on to in terms of policy recommendations at the end. So going right back to the beginning, you guys felt that there's not a lot of data. In fact, there's next to nothing available from the platforms, from the FCA, from the UK Crowdfunding Association, or all these other people who are, quotes, paid as their day job to do this kind of stuff. So you filled the vacuum. And presumably at the time you thought it was a good idea, and then you found out it was a hell of a lot of hard work. I mean, that's one thing that stuck in my mind from your report. How much hard work went into finding whether these companies are still going?
Yeah, look, and I think, you know, this is a very young industry, and I don't want to be critical of the platforms or the industry bodies.
It's 4 years old. I mean, it depends what you mean by young.
Yeah, but I think it's, I just hope that by putting this out there, it affects some change, and I'm sure it will. And just to be clear, there were two things we were seeking to achieve from this report. Firstly, we just wanted to state the facts of how many companies that have crowdfunded have failed or are struggling and how many are still going. And we're very confident we have done that.
And that's very hard to establish, as we'll come on to.
Yeah, well, and we'll come on to that. And the second thing we wanted to make clear was, you know, it's good that this data is now out there. It would be good if the industry could find a way to make sure this data continued to be available.
Exactly, or improve on it, or change it, or start a debate, or say, actually, we don't agree with them in this way, or we think it should be done that way, but actually do something rather than just chuck balls at coconuts.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, those are the two primary objectives. You know, when it comes to trying to discern what returns have been achieved, other bits of analysis, that's all interesting and informative, but It's very early days, you know, and we were at pains to make those caveats. I would go back to the point, there were two primary objectives. What are the historic facts and what should we be trying to do with this data?
Yes. So what are the facts then? Or more importantly, how did you find the facts? Because fact is a word that means something in its own right, doesn't it?
Good question. So, you know, some of this data is available from Companies House.
How many companies have, going back to numbers, how many companies have done this, equity crowdfunding?
Our report covered 360-odd companies who between them had done 430-odd raises. We then reviewed all those companies at Companies House, which is a fantastic resource, albeit it is quite late, you know, in that there can be a lag between something changing and it being updated at Companies House.
Is it something like 18 months?
Well, it depends.
Well, I mean, I've had a company for 17 years and, you know, I can be quite late in submitting my report without getting beaten too much.
So, you know, lags can be that long, yes.
That's a very important point to remember because people get so carried away about this world of data and fintech and all this kind of stuff without realising it still has to interface with the old world somewhere along the line. And in the UK, I don't know how it happens elsewhere, there is this place called Companies House. And if you run a company, you have to send your information there, but you have to send it there on Dickensian timescales, like within 18 months rather than within 18 milliseconds.
Exactly, exactly. And actually, you know, it comes back to a lot of things here where, you know, crowdfunding is an amazing innovation, but often people set it against stock markets. And clearly a lot of things have received a bad press post the crisis. And to me, it's utter insanity that stock markets have received a bad press. I mean, it's totally oversimplistic. The reality is that stock markets serve an amazing purpose and are incredibly well regulated. And having spent the first 13 years of my career working in stock markets, there was a lot I came to take for granted because there is a huge amount of transparency brought about by the regulations, by the fact that prices are continually updating.
And you couldn't leave it 18 months before some information goes out.
Correct, correct. So to answer your question, we reviewed all these companies at Companies House, and then we figured, okay, hang on a minute, we need to bring this data up to date. So we need a much more live way of surveying where these companies are right now. And actually, to your point about the old world interfacing with the new world, we used some fairly old world techniques. The first thing we did was just call all these companies. If you call a company 3 times a week for 3 weeks and nobody answers the phone, it's a pretty good clue that all may not be well. If the line's been cut off, it's an even stronger clue. If somebody picks up the phone and says, yeah, we're going great, and answers a few questions, then that helps you as well. So we called all the companies, we emailed all the companies, we filled in online forms, we looked at consumer surveys, consumer reviews, we looked at Twitter feeds, Facebook feeds. You know, Twitter and Facebook, for example, if the founder or the company had been enthusiastically tweeting for the first 12 months, and then 6 months ago the tweets dried up, it's quite a good clue that maybe something's amiss.
Yes, and just pressing pause at that point to say, so you know, there've been various spins, and one of them is to criticise the report, and the other one is to say it's absolutely brilliant and this shows that equity crowdfunding is wonderful, by which I mean people just sort of use your report to say what they were going to say in the first place before it was published, in a sense. So those people that criticise it have not been through the, presumably, months of work, the painstaking months of work, just to find out whether the company's gone bust or not. You know, you can't even find that out. I mean, there's FCAs and platforms and...
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of wild assertions out there like there normally are. I mean, look, you know, if I was to define myself going into this report, I was quite sceptical. Crowdfunding is not the focus of my business, okay? And I was probably pretty sceptical and cynical going into this. Actually, from my starting point, I was enormously impressed by the results. Now, clearly, I would caveat that, as any reader of the report should, by saying, you know, there are very few companies in the 2011 sample. There are a few more in the 2012 sample. Most of the companies are in the 2014-2015 sample, and it's way too early to reach any definitive conclusions. Nonetheless, from what I can see in 2011, 12, and 13, many more of these companies are still going than I imagined would be the case.
So what are the fag packet numbers on how much equity was raised in equity crowdfunding in, say, 11, 12, 13, 14? And I ask you that because I kindly bought a copy of your report in case you hadn't remembered it and you're sitting there in front of you.
So actually, there's an unhelpful symmetry with the numbers. Our report covers 140 million or so of equity capital raises. And our report has a cutoff at June the 30th of this year. So from inception to June the 30th, 140 million sterling of equity capital raised. The other number that we've put out there is that over the course of 2015, 145 million of equity capital will be extended via equity crowdfunding. So you can see that there is an amazing growth rate going on here. Full year 2015, more capital will be extended than all of 2011 up to the half year 2015.
So it's growing incredibly fast. And the other couple of stats that at a big picture stuck in my mind, the average age, and this seems to be a shock to a lot of people, I mean, the FCA, as I say, talking to the Treasury Select Committee, we're talking about startups, but the average age of a company that's done equity crowdfunding over this period, you estimated, was roughly 3 years, which to me isn't a startup. I mean, if you carried on for 3 years, you've gone beyond being a startup. You know, you're trundling down the runway at best. You found that actually you can pay the bills and keep the lights on somehow. So it's not startups. And then the second thing, which the FT managed to invert, was that, going back to your skepticism about what you'd find, you found that based on your methodology, which is the best you could adopt, and I haven't seen anyone else have a different methodology, you estimate that something like 4 out of 5 companies that have crowdfunded are still going. Now, as you say, some of them have done it recently and all that, but nevertheless, that's quite a high number. And the FT, of course, span it in terms of 1 out of 5 has gone bust.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really hard to benchmark this. There's a mantra which you hear repeated quite often, which is that 9 out of 10 startups fail. We couldn't actually find a definitive report to tell us that. And I think increasingly that mantra should get discredited. The best data points we could find was a Royal & Sun Alliance report suggesting that around 55% of startups failed. And another really interesting data point was a Nesta report suggesting that around 50% of angel-funded companies end up failing. Now, there's some important distinctions to be made here. You know, an angel-funded company or a crowd-funded company have both just enjoyed a large slug of equity capital. Okay, so they are different from just startups, okay, which might not have enjoyed that same slug of equity capital. Another point to make, just going back to your previous observation about 3+ years old, you know, there's a horrendously oversimplistic comment made about this wider disintermediated space where people say, oh, look, the P2P guys, they're just, you know, funding loans that the banks turn away. Well, that's nonsense. They have at least as stringent criteria as the banks. And it's the same, actually, if we look at equity crowdfunding. Why are these companies of an average age of 3+ years? Well, it's because the platforms demand, you know, some basic standards before they'll list a campaign. They want to see some numbers. They want to see some trading history. They want to list a company that is able to make some realistic projections.
Yes, we'll come back to the sort of the listing standards, shall we call it, of the platforms in a minute, because that's quite an interesting one. So, as you say, you actually tried to find what objective information there was out there for this mantra of 9 out of 10, which seems to be totally unevidenced. I saw recently a tweet saying that the Office of National Statistics had said that I think for startups from 2009, 41% were still going 6 years later. And again, I think that for people who have got the wrong end of the stick on this report, from reading it through the media, old or new, I think the main takeaway here is that it's incredibly hard to get any data. The data that everybody repeats, I mean, I'm sure I've repeated myself this 9 out of 10 mantra, actually is totally unevidenced. And to the extent there is data out there, it's that after a few years, about half of startups are still going. And as you say at the moment, roughly 80% of equity crowdfunded firms are still going, and they were 3 years old when they started, and maybe they haven't quite got to the sort of 5 years yet. So it does come back to the question that the FCA is encouraging this rubric that most of these companies are going to go bust. But where's the evidence? I mean, maybe it may be true, but there's no evidence for that assertion.
Yeah, look, it's a great point. And, you know, I don't envy the job they've got to do. We all know, you know, any student of behavioural psychology knows that the human brain loves black and white and is really uncomfortable with shades of grey. The human brain likes to go from one end of the spectrum to the other. It doesn't recognise that actually, you know, the reality is normally somewhere in the middle and can't be simplified into one end of the spectrum or the other. So, you know, it isn't easy to deal with all of this. My observation would be, you know, actually the FCA's risk warning that be aware when you're investing in equity crowdfunding, most startups fail, is definitely an oversimplification, and it's probably too strong.
I entirely agree. They should change that. Well, either they should produce evidence that that is true, or they should change that too. There is a very high probability that if you invest in one firm, you could lose all your money. Well, there is data for that.
Absolutely. You know, thank you, because actually that brings us back to exactly what we're trying to do. What we're saying is, if I'm a prospective crowdfunding investor, and I come to a platform and I identify a really interesting campaign that maybe I know something about the sector, I've used the product, I've got excited about it, and I think I might want to invest in it. To however great an extent I can appraise the merits of that campaign, part of my due diligence should be to say, okay, I could be wrong. What does history tell me about the likelihood of me being wrong? And what does being wrong look like? Well, number one, being wrong when you invest in equity looks like zero normally, okay? And number two, there should be some objective statistics to show how many of these campaigns, which at the outset all looked really exciting and sexy, how many of them didn't end up working out. And this shouldn't be based on assertion. You should direct the prospective investor to the facts and he can reach his own conclusion.
Absolutely. So, you know, in terms of, as you say, it's a new sector. The regulator's got a lot on their plate. The regulation is changing. However, it would be clearly a good idea if when people are regulated as equity crowdfunding platforms, they at least have to give the regulator some basic data. We're not talking about how the banks report to the BOV and the PRA and they give them an infinite amount of data, but even some simple stuff like, oh, I'm the regulator, you're a platform, Rupert, so actually, if you want to be regulated, you know what, every quarter, just tell me how many deals you've done, what the total volume was, how many of the past firms have gone bust. Well, that's a start, and then next year I'm going to ask you for something else. And there's something else, the other point that's been raised, which I'm entirely in agreement with, you don't cover it in your report, but it's been raised by other people, which is in terms of profit forecasts at launch. And I think I did read something implying that this is going to be covered in the US regulation for equity crowdfunding over there. I'm not sure, I haven't seen the actual sort of bedrock details of that. But clearly the concern there, and again, the regulator is in a very good place to ask for the data and track it, is that let's say there is a platform, and let's say they have 100 firms listing, and let's say 1 or 2 or 3 years down the track, 99 of those firms didn't meet any of their profit forecasts whatsoever. then if I'm the regulator, in old city terms, I'm going to raise an eyebrow or two at you.
Yeah, look, and this is another step down the road, and it's a long way beyond the ambition of our report. And I would again point back to my earlier comment about not taking for granted the wonder of stock markets. You know, in the stock market, you know you're going to get, well, probably quarterly reporting, certainly half-year reporting, and if only half-year reporting, you're going to get trading updates. So you're regularly going to get to see how the company's performing versus expectations. The other point I would make is this isn't all beholden on the platforms, okay? My view is that the platforms need to convey to the companies that this wonderful new capital that they are allowing them to access, this wonderful new source of capital, brings with it responsibilities. This is not just the responsibilities of the platform. It is also the responsibility of the companies to recognize I'm accessing a different kind of capital. I'm accessing generally retail investors, okay, who are not enjoying the benefit of huge amounts of disclosure and are taking quite a lot of risk. I should help those investors make as richly appraised a decision as possible.
I entirely agree. And of course, coming, you know, as we do from sort of old FS, solid FS, you know, we can't differ in the slightest of this, and it's certainly true that the fluffy bunny propaganda around equity crowdfunding is the new way of democratization, the wisdom of the crowd and all that. Okay, I hear that, there's a bit of that. But also, again, I saw a tweet the other day which was quoting some VC that said, oh, I love equity crowdfunding because it's smart, dumb capital. You know, so there's a real politic that there are people out there, as there always have been for centuries, who are trying to raise stuff at a high price and keep people in the dock. And I think going back to the sector maturing, the stock exchange is a good example. If you want to list on the London Stock Exchange, there's a whole bunch of requirements that you have to accept to go on it. If you want to go on AIM, the kind of second tier market as it were in the UK, there's a lower hurdle. The hurdle standards on equity crowdfunding platform are at best uneven. It's really quite hard to measure, shall we say, the due diligence standards that the top three players do in the UK. I mean, I spend all my time in this, as do you, and, you know, privately over a beer, we could have a sort of bit of a stab in the dark at it, but it would be a stab in the dark at it. So there's a lot that can be done in terms of tightening it up. And there's also this painful tension, which I think is why the regulator has to set some standards, because the UK Crowdfunding Association has had plenty of time and hasn't set any whatsoever, which is that, let's say you're going to be holier than thou and you give up OppFi data tomorrow and you're going to set up a new platform and you're going to say, we've got very strict standards of due diligence and we check the pricing and we've got all these listing requirements and you the company, are going to have to sort of tell us daily whether you've gone bust and every 15 seconds what your profit's been in the last 15 seconds. That, surprise, surprise, commercially, you ain't going to be successful. So there's the tension which says that actually the lowest hurdle, frankly, you can get away with is going to produce the most flow of volume in the short term. So there's all these complexities which are still out there. And I think you're right, which is it is early days. And, you know, my feeling is that the P2P market is, quotes, a bit more grown up than equity.
Yeah, you know, I think you raised some really, really interesting points.
I read my fortune cookies this morning.
What it comes down to for me is that markets that succeed thrive on trust, okay? And everything will never be priced perfectly. That is a fantasy. That is not going to happen, okay? But a successful asset class or a successful market will evolve if, once some time has passed, both companies that have funded and investors that have provided the funding can look back and recognize that, in the light of the available information, that was funded at a reasonable price. If that can't be said, then down the line, either the companies will stop coming there to fund or the investors will stop coming back to provide the funding. Okay, so if you want to build a sustainable asset class, trust is absolutely central. You have to get as much information out there as possible. And that's because it goes back to shades of grey. You know, do I believe in efficient markets or not? You know, it's a nonsense question. There are shades of grey of efficiencies. What I would say is that there is normally enough efficiency out there that eventually the market will recognize, hang on a minute, things are getting funded at excessive valuations here or overly low valuations, and one side of the transaction will therefore shy away. You know, but you only allow efficiency to thrive if you provide the transparency.
Yes, and the problem is around the word eventually. I mean, was it Keynes who said eventually we're all dead?
That's black and white, I concede.
You're in a very grey and black and white day today. No, I entirely agree, and it's, as I say, it is for the FCA. and the platforms and the companies to work their way through it. You can grow a business very rapidly by having low hurdles, letting people do overambitious profit targets and not get involved very much, and it will look very successful in the short term, and you might even make some money. But actually, you know, we do know that there are people out there who are actually trying to build businesses for the 5 and 10 year view, and different countries are watching how we do things. I was talking to Alexandra Gaillard, who, amongst other things, founded the Swiss FinTech Association, who was explaining that the Swiss approach is to watch what we do for a while, see all the mistakes we make, and then not make those mistakes, you know? So there's a whole world of equity crowdfunding that could take off, and what actually works, we will see. Moving on, Rupert, because I think we've, you know, given a good flavour of how difficult it is to get some hardcore data, and, you know, I think you slightly underemphasise, out of modesty, the sheer hard work, the volume of time and effort you had to spend just to try and get some basic stats like, oh, we think 80% are still going. It's really very hard, and I think that needs to be tightened up by the sector. So just wrapping up, time's going by. You mentioned the US. I was very interested. We're in Liberum's office at the moment, and it's Liberum Alt Fi Data Indices. And at the Lendit conference, Callum was talking about the problems of getting data around the world in terms of how big the market is and what's happening and all that kind of stuff. And surprisingly, the US is a very hard market to get data on. You might expect otherwise. And when I had Andrew Mullinger, co-founder of Funding Circle, on, who spent a lot of time in the States with their business over there, and I asked him where they are on the league table of business lenders in the US. He said, well, we don't really know because there isn't really any data out there. It's quite astonishing. So why is that phenomenon? And secondly, what are you doing about it then?
Yeah, great question. So look, we're delighted that we have launched a prototype of our US returns index, and it's built around the big two US P2P platforms, LendingClub and Prosper. But those are consumer lending platforms. Okay, so we can now definitively show you what an investor would have experienced in terms of returns from LendingClub and Prosper.
If they bought every loan from LendingClub and Prosper, you mean is this kind of...
Correct.
Average or median or whatever I mean?
Correct. So effectively, it's a time-weighted return, and it's the return they would have enjoyed in the last 12 months. Yeah. Okay, so it's a 12-month trailing average return, and the number is about, off the top of my head, it's about 8-odd%.
And just in passing, what's the UK equivalent then in terms of percent?
Getting on towards 6.
Right.
But the US is quite different from the UK in that it's dominated by consumer. So the biggest platforms at the moment out there are consumer lending platforms. And SME is slower to evolve. You know, that is changing partly with, you know, the great innovators at Funding Circle going over there and making things happen. But there is actually a very healthy layer of SME-focused platforms growing in the US. So we're very excited about working with those guys. Funding Circle are fantastically transparent. You know, arguably they led the way in transparency in the UK. You know, they're equally transparent in the US. They are very helpful in terms of working with us in the US. And there are a whole raft of other very exciting US SME platforms who we hope to work with to begin to reveal what SME peer-to-peer lending returns have been in the US. I guess the only caveat I have to make is, you know, we like some history behind our data. So obviously in the UK, we can go back to Zopa starting in 2005. In the US, I think we go back as far as 2008, maybe 2007. You know, SME lending in the US is still a pretty new phenomenon. So, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time. So, you know, it's almost back to the crowdfunding report. People have got to be patient. It takes time to be able to come up with any definitive views on returns in these sorts of asset classes.
Yes. So rounding up, I think that, you know, what you guys have achieved in the last year or so is immensely impressive, is immensely valuable. You guys are more conscious than anybody else that it's a start, that more will be done next year and the year after. And it really does fill a gap in the whole ecosystem in terms of making these markets more professional, less string and sellotape, and more of a grown-up investment for grown-ups. And I know that you've got all sorts of interesting plans potentially on the boil for next year, and I wish you every success in that, Rupert.
Thank you very much for having me, Mike, and yes, thank you for your encouragement.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, Watching a happy moon ride. Watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. The city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.